Illinois Republicans say changing our income tax system will drive businesses out of the state. Is that true? We'll take a look back into our recent history and talk about whether taxes actually cause people to leave. Plus, Illinois healthcare professionals are working on the best ways to help children deal with trauma, including a new collaborative at the University of Chicago. And the long decline of Sears has taken an unexpected turn. The retailer is now suing its former chairman and CEO, Eddie Lampert, saying he stole billions of dollars.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up today, Illinois healthcare professionals are working on a new collaborative to help treat children who are suffering trauma. Plus, Sears filed for bankruptcy 6 months ago. Now the company is suing its former chairman and CEO, Eddie Lampert, saying he stripped the company of billions as it was heading into bankruptcy. But first, Illinois voters could have a big decision to make in November of 2020. And no, I'm not talking about your state lawmakers, your member of Congress, or even the vote for president. If Governor Pritzker and Illinois Democrats have their way, you'll be voting on whether or not to amend our Illinois Constitution so that lawmakers can change our income tax system. Right now, the rate is the same no matter how much or little you make. Governor Pritzker says we should have a progressive tax system where higher earners pay more, lower earners pay less. You probably already heard a lot about this issue, including political ads from dark money groups. Others are saying this will be yet another blow to Illinois' business climate, maybe even cause more people to leave Illinois. But what actually happens when a state changes its income taxes? Well, we already have some idea, thanks in part to some reporting by the Better Government Association. Bob Sector and Tim Jones reported on this for the BGA. Bob is a senior editor with the BGA. Tim's a regular contributor focusing on Illinois policy and economics. Both of them are in studio with me here in Chicago. Good morning. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here, guys.
Good morning.
So let me just start with just the whole issue just of with what we're seeing around this possible change to our tax structure. How much are we hearing about this issue? Tim, how much do you think people are getting misinformation about this issue?
Well, there's plenty of information out there, myths and otherwise, and you're just going to hear more. I got three pieces of mail last week, and here we are 18 months away from the election.
And what did those pieces of mail say?
Well,
not to spread more misinformation, but
one that the so-called fair tax is going to make it more equitable in the state for taxpayers, and the opposition is don't believe what those guys are saying. And this is just a warm-up of what is coming. An enormous amount of money is going to be spent on this.
And Bob, I imagine we're not just going to be seeing mailers, we're going to be seeing campaign ads.
I was telling Tim earlier, I was watching a baseball game last night, and there were several Think Big ads. That's the governor's issue advocacy group that is supporting the graduated tax. So, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Okay. Yeah. So, let's go over to what the facts of this might look like. And for this, you guys actually went back to 2011, and you looked at the tax change that happened back then. That's correct, Bob?
Yeah. We, back in the very first few weeks of 2011, the then Democratic-controlled legislature and the Democratic governor, Pat Quinn, passed and he signed a tax increase which raised Illinois' flat tax from 3% to 5%. They also built in a reduction schedule that after 4 years it would fall down to 3.75% if nothing changed. The arguments back then are almost boilerplate what they are today. The state is going to, be destroyed and fall into Lake Michigan, or we need this very much because we have severe financial problems. We have big debts, big pension debt, and our credit rating is tanking, and we need to do something about this. And that was no different then than it is now.
So, Tim, you guys looked at federal tax data from 2006 to 2016, right?
Right.
And so for a three-year period within that, the state raised the flat rate to 5%. What happened to Illinois taxpayers during those 3 years, from 2011 to 2014?
It was it did not satisfy the predictions of critics. What you saw was that the wealthy, those making more than $100,000 a year, actually thrived. Their numbers went up, while people making less than $50,000 a year, their numbers dropped. Now, this is not to say that there is causation here necessarily, but we're not making a prediction. We're not taking part in an argument, but we're looking at the data coming from an unbiased source, Internal Revenue Service.
Right, because obviously there were lots of things happening between 2011 and 2014.
Right.
But just on the face of it, during those 3 years, when the state tax went up to 5%, what you're saying is that we didn't see more wealthy people leave the state.
No.
We actually saw the opposite, is what you're saying.
Well, if the drain that occurred was at the lower income level, and it was substantial, and the numbers of the wealthy increased based on filings by a substantial amount.
And so, Bob, was this different also across regional lines throughout the state?
It's more severe downstate and in poor minority neighborhoods in Chicago. There were several booming neighborhoods in Chicago as well, where you did see this big increase of wealthier people. And those things, again, we can't correlate that, but we certainly can say that it defied the predictions.
So it defied the predictions. Basically, when conservatives – I mean, Tim, what we hear is that conservatives are afraid that higher income earners and businesses will leave if taxes are raised. Basically, what you're saying is in this three-year period, that was not the case.
Well, I think what the data show is that it's a lot more complicated than that. People in the political realm, people like to draw the connection cause and effect and blame taxes for everything that is bad that happens. And there are many, many factors in that, and you can't point to just one thing as to why people are leaving the state of Illinois.
I'm speaking with Tim Jones, a contributor to the BGA, and Bob Sector, a senior editor. We've been talking about what actually happened when Illinois temporarily raised our state income tax 8 years ago. I want to welcome someone else into this conversation. Therese McGuire is a professor of strategy with Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Management, where she's on the line from now. Hi, Therese. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
So, Therese, as Bob and Tim have been telling us about how taxpayers actually fared when the state raised its income tax rate from around, it was, I believe, around 3%. Is that correct, Tim?
It went from 3 to 5.
3 to 5 in 2011. I wonder, when we're thinking about what Tim was just saying, Therese, about how politicians like to blame taxes kind of for everything, what do we know about our tax rate in general and whether that actually causes people to move in the first place?
Yeah, there have been plenty of good systematic studies of the effect of taxes on population growth, economic activity over the last several decades, and some very recent ones that have focused in on actually the top marginal tax rate for the individual income tax and its effect on economic activity. And the studies are consistent over time. There does not appear to be a strong negative effect of higher taxes on economic activity at the state level or in population growth at the state level. The couple of recent studies looking at the top marginal tax rate on the income tax find that the top marginal income tax rate bears no stable relationship to economic growth across states and over time when you're looking at all the states and their income tax systems.
I want to stop you because I wanted you to say that again because I think that might be it's and sometimes this does get complicated, right? So you're saying that whatever the tax rate is at the highest level, so for the richest people, the data shows that doesn't have an effect. Am I understanding you correctly?
That's what the studies are showing exactly. When we zero in on the tax rate increases or decreases in the tax, the top marginal tax rate, the top tax rate on income, it does not seem to have an effect on economic activity. It doesn't decrease jobs. It doesn't increase jobs. It seems to have no effect, no relationship. In fact, there's some evidence that sometimes it bears a positive relationship. You increase the top marginal tax rate and you get increase in economic activity. But the bottom line of this research, and there have been some quite good, well-identified studies in recent years, is that there's not a relationship between top income tax rates at the state level and economic activity in those states.
So I wonder, Bob, why you think these tax rates are prone to this kind of oversimplification, just because I wonder, and Tim, feel free to jump in here. Both of you are longtime Chicago journalists. You're no stranger to understanding political rhetoric, regardless of whether it's around a campaign or a policy issue like this.
In this era, we have the we're trying to scare everybody. We're trying to tell people that if this change happens, your life will be ruined, or you'll cost so much you'll want to leave. We see this around lots of things, that not just the income tax. We see this around arguments about the gas tax now. We see this around arguments about the minimum wage. The way to win your argument is to scare enough people into saying that change is bad.
And the flip side of that is also presented, especially by Republicans, that if you cut taxes, it's going to be wonderful. And a great example of that is what happened in the state of Kansas starting in 2012, when the Republican Governor Sam Brownback proposed and obtained major cuts in the state income tax. And his argument was, we're going to be just like Texas. We're going to have huge population growth. We're going to stimulate the economy. And it flat out did not happen. The state lost a lot of money. The population did not grow.
So, Teresa, someone who studies this, I wonder what actually you think. I mean, I've talked to lots of business leaders about what matters to them in terms of why they move, what grows the economy, what kinds of things do you think we should be talking about instead of the tax rate to create better economic conditions for people to want to stay and have businesses here in Illinois?
I think what we should be talking about in Illinois is raising enough revenue to, in a systematic way, pay down our unfunded liabilities in the state. I think what businesses care deeply about is what I'll call fiscal policy uncertainty. And in Illinois, we have this huge overhang of unfunded pension liabilities. We also tend to go from year to year with budget deficits that we have to fix at the end of the fiscal year. But we have unfunded liabilities, and any business person thinking about expanding in the state or moving to the state, they know that they're going to have to bear part of that burden, and they want that's costly for the state to be in this situation. And the sooner we can address those unfunded liabilities, the better. And one way to address those unfunded liabilities is, you know, to increase taxes and put them into paying for those pension liabilities.
Therese, do you say, then when we think about this, I mean, I know you talked to Bob and Tim about the fact that Wisconsin and Iowa have higher tax rates, but that's also,
right.
These are also states where Illinoisans are moving. So when we think about what those states have that we don't, I wonder how much of it, the unfunded pension liability is part of it. What else do you think is in there?
Yeah. I don't know about Iowa's pension liability, but I do know that Wisconsin has one of the best funded pensions in the country. So they do not have that worry. I think that businesses care. They do care about what's going on fiscally and what's going on in the government sector. They care about spending on infrastructure and education. They want to have a well-educated labor force. They want to have transportation infrastructure that functions. And so I think there are some of these studies out there are also showing that spending on infrastructure and education is a plus for businesses. They want to see that government is providing the goods and services that are needed for their firms and for the people that are working for them.
So when we think about the fact that when we think about people leaving, I wonder Therese, what you think about when we think about the problem of, for example, college students, and we've seen that been documented. I wonder how much you think our pension, the unfunded liability, does that, do you think, add to a climate of just instability, or how do you think that trickles down?
I am not sure that college students are aware of.
That's what I would think, right?
Yeah, right. So I can't speak to what's going on with the trends with college age kids and where they're moving to and moving away from.
I guess where we're at, though, is that with Bob, we've been speaking with Therese McGuire, who's a professor of strategy at Kellogg and Northwestern University, Bob Sector and Tim Jones, about some reporting they did about what happened when the state actually temporarily raised the state income tax 8 years ago. Guys, as we move forward here, as we started this conversation talking about the rhetoric, I wonder how much more we're going to see you all, we're going to see this rhetoric ramp up. I mean, we're not even, this isn't even on the ballot yet.
No.
You've got, sometime between now and the end of May, when the legislative session is supposed to be done, we may see a vote on putting the referendum on the 2020 ballot. There is no 2019 ballot. And that's only step one. If that passes, and it takes an extraordinary majority of the legislature to do it. So assuming that gets on the ballot, this will only intensify.
We're almost out of time, but Tim, just very quickly, I wonder what you want people to think about as they're hearing conversation, maybe reading inaccurate things about this.
Well, I would put more trust in the printed word than I would in the broadcast ad, because broadcast ads are all about distortion, 95% of it, I think. Mm-hmm. So I would read trusted sources of news and really disregard what you hear on the air.
That's Tim Jones, except a disregard for paid advertising, we should say, on the air. Tim Jones is a contributor to the VGA. I want to thank Bob Sector and Therese McGuire from Northwestern University for being with me. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When we report on a new state-of-the-art medical facilities to treat trauma victims, whether they're in Rockford, Champaign, or Chicago, we're usually talking about the ability to quickly respond or provide urgent medical care. But many of trauma's long-lasting effects are left untreated. This is especially true for our youngest patients. That's the big idea behind a lot of work being done by healthcare professionals all across Illinois. And the most recent example is a new collaborative at the University of Chicago Medicine Comer Children's Hospital. WBEZ's Natalie Moore recently reported on this. She joins us now from our studio here at Chicago's Lakeview neighborhood on the north side. Hey, Natalie, it's nice to have you here in person.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
Brad Stolbeck is also on the line with us. He's a pediatric trauma psychologist at Comer Children's Hospital. And Colleen Cicchetti is the executive director of the Center for Childhood Resilience. She's on the line from Chicago as well. Brad, Colleen, thank you for being with me.
Happy to be here.
Brad, I wonder if we can start just when we're thinking about just this whole idea of children and trauma. When we say I wonder if you can just start by describing who the patients are you expect to treat at this new collaborative. When we say trauma victims, who are we talking about particularly?
Sure. Trauma can mean a lot of things, and in this context, that's true as well. This collaborative is going to expand our capacity to take care of any children and their families who've experienced all kinds of trauma. That can include violence in the community. It could include other kinds of violence. It could also include other kinds of medical trauma, burns, dog attacks, and also other forms of psychological trauma, witnessing violence, and so forth. There is an emphasis, because we are based in level one trauma centers, on medical trauma, physical injuries resulting from community violence, and that is where the bulk of the patients will be coming from.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk about that more in a minute. But Colleen, when we're thinking about the whole idea of having health care that's trauma informed, what does that mean?
So what it means is really thinking about, almost like Brad was saying, there's lots of ways that kids can be exposed to trauma. And what we're talking about is for healthcare providers at every level of care, from primary prevention all the way through to the intensive kinds of services that Brad just mentioned, is really thinking about what are the factors that are bringing this family here today. Maybe they're coming in for an appointment because of asthma, but the likelihood that they're going to be able to follow up with their asthma treatment is going to be impacted by lots of other types of trauma as well. So it's asking that, or trauma and stress and exposure. So we need to address the reason they're coming to see us in terms of a medical intervention, but we also need to be having a more holistic approach to saying, you know, what's happening to this family, what are going to be the barriers to them getting the medical treatment they need, and also are there other stressors going on that we can help address, if that's food insecurity, if it's exposure to violence, how are we as healthcare providers really part of a universal solution to thinking about being much more proactive in supporting kids and families?
So, Brad, when we're thinking about this for you at Comer Children's Hospital, are you working then? Is this just part of this mean training healthcare professionals, not just doctors, but nurses and everyone who's coming in contact with patients and families?
Absolutely. That is part of the work that we do. And again, this collaborative, this expansion will help us to do even more of that. We are aiming to really train everyone who might come into contact with a patient or family served by our hospitals, regardless of the reason that the patient is there, to approach that care in a trauma-informed way. That is understanding that what people have experienced, what they've been through, can really affect how they experience the care that they're receiving, experience what's happening to them in that moment. And so we're working to train everyone from executive leadership and administration to the frontline doctors, nurses on the ground, and everyone else who works in those settings.
So, Brett, can you take us through an example of what this might mean? You said this is, of course, trauma can take many forms, but because you are in particular, some of the people who you might be dealing with, the children might be dealing with issues of violence. If someone has, a child has been a victim of violence, what will be different care-wise here?
So what this is really going to do is provide a continuum of care from the time that a person comes to the hospital. In fact, if they're level one trauma activation for, say, a gunshot wound, that actually starts before they even arrive at the hospital. So child life is mobilized, and child life are the folks in our hospital who are there to assist children with dealing with whatever's happening to them in the hospital. So they're assisting them with the emotional management of procedures that they might be experiencing or just the situation that they're in. They're activated. Our chaplains are activated, who are part of our violence recovery team, and our violence recovery specialists. So that's right away, all those folks are available, and they're there to support that individual patient who may be coming in, as I said, with a gunshot wound, but also to support that family that's there with that patient, and to make sure that they are as comfortable as they can be under the circumstances, that they're getting the information that is possible for them to get in a timely manner, that they understand what's happening to the degree that that's possible, and also that they are connected with the other resources that we have that are going to stay with them beyond that initial injury. And so this collaborative also includes our programs that provide for victims of violent injury, ongoing intensive case management services. That's through Healing Hurt People Chicago, which is a partnership of Stroger Hospital and University of Chicago, and also the University of Chicago Medicine REACT program, which provides ongoing trauma-informed or trauma-focused counseling, therapy, psychiatric care.
That's Brad Stolbeck, a pediatric trauma psychologist at University of Chicago Medicine's Comer Children's Hospital. Brad, I know you have to run, but thanks for taking the time to speak with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks. I was happy to be here.
Colleen, as we're listening to Brad talk about this whole idea of just in terms of when it comes to violence and trauma, certainly we know that violence can cause other violence, and I wonder how much you think trauma-informed care is about preventing future acts of violence as well.
Absolutely. We know that hurt people are more likely to hurt other people, so we know that if we can intervene at any intervention point in helping someone to heal from that hurt, that initial hurt, they're less likely to hurt others, which is partly why we think of this as a public health approach in terms of we need to also be thinking about even just witnessing. You know, when we talk about the impact of violence in our communities, it's not just the direct victims, but it's also all the other folks that have been impacted, either by losing someone that they love, having witnessed it, maybe even having someone be a classmate. So we really are talking about this from a holistic approach of looking at prevention definitely as one of the positive outcomes of supporting kids in particular that have been impacted by exposure to traumatic events.
That's Colleen Cicchetti, Executive Director of the Center for Childhood Resilience. Natalie Moore is also in studio with me here. Natalie, when we're thinking specifically about WBEZ Southside, we're actually almost coming up on the year anniversary of an adult trauma center also based at the University of Chicago. How much of this came from the community saying that this was needed?
A lot of it. The trauma, the fight to reopen a level one adult trauma center has been several years. The university hospital closed it a couple of decades ago, but they've always have maintained their pediatric trauma center. When they opened the adult level one trauma center last May, which isn't a building, it's just a complex web of services, there was a community advisory board. And the surgeon who was brought in, the lead surgeon said, you know, we want to deal with violence prevention. We want to help people when they leave here. So that's been part of the ethos of this trauma center. And then a couple of weeks ago, there was an announcement of a $9 million gift to the hospital. The Block Hassenfeld Kasdan Collaborative for Family Resilience, that's a mouthful, that's the collaborative that Brad was talking about, that's doing these wraparound services. They'll be violence recovery specialists and child life specialists. And these could be social workers, but they could also be community people who can come in. So there's definitely a link, because even if you're dealing with a child who didn't experience trauma, perhaps an adult in their life experienced trauma and they're there. And so then someone can reach out to that child. But it's what Colleen is saying, holistic care services, wraparound. Those are the guiding principles for all of this work.
And so, Natalie, when we're talking about this collaborative in Chicago, this isn't necessarily like a new building. This is just going to be
Correct.
A new way of looking at resources.
Correct.
Colleen, how important is it, whether we're talking about healthcare professionals, we've been talking about caring for kids in trauma in a professional setting like a hospital. I wonder if you have, where else we're seeing work. I know you've done work with the school district in Champaign. Where else are we seeing other trauma-informed responses to helping particularly children?
Yeah, that's really important to know. It's really becoming an issue of what are all the different child care serving entities that kids and families interact with, and how can they both be trauma aware, which is to understand how trauma impacts folks, how it might change our physiology, how it might make us more anxious in certain situations, but more importantly, thinking about all the different sectors and how we might change our practices. So that's not to say we're trying to create psychologists and social workers in every domain, but if we are a librarian or an educator or a Girl Scout leader or a soccer coach, are we thinking to ourselves when we're interacting with kids, We don't know what's in that kid's backpack. We don't know how they came to us today. So are we doing things in our setting, whatever that setting might be, that can help make them feel some key things? And the key things are really, do they feel safe physically and emotionally with me? Do they have a relationship where they believe I have their back? And then ultimately, am I teaching them strategies around self-regulation that they can use in their day-to-day life in addition to this setting? So we really are talking about sort of a non-traditional mental health providers. And in Chicago, that includes, there's a collaborative of trauma-informed hospitals. There's about 25 or 30 hospitals that are looking to each other and sharing best practices. We also have a collaborative for faith communities coming together and saying, what's our role as faith leaders in supporting our family members who have been impacted by trauma? And so there's really an effort to sort of say any of these. And I'm in a conversation this morning with people talking about early childhood education and how can we build the capacity of home daycare providers and child care centers and home visiting to really build up the capacity for understanding how trauma might impact both a child but also a parent who's trying to help raise that child. So it really is it's a pretty universal precautions sort of way of thinking. And we're seeing that, like you mentioned, not just in Chicago, but also across the state. So we've had a lot of interest in Champaign. We actually, in May, were declaring Senator Morrison has decided that, you know, has put out a practice to say, let's be a trauma-aware state across the state, because we're getting requests from school districts and healthcare providers and school, you know, after-school programs and Boys and Girls Clubs, summer camps from all across the whole state. It's not just in Chicago.
And I wonder, Natalie, I want to ask you this question, and then Colleen, I'd love to have you follow up with all the communities you're working in. But I think, Natalie, when we're thinking about communities that suffer from violence, how much are we hearing from the communities themselves saying that mental health is a key part of this equation here?
Oh, absolutely. That's been something that advocates have been pushing for a long time, especially given the mental health closures that happened under Mayor Rahm Emanuel's administration. And it also goes beyond mental health. These wraparound services could help families find housing, child care.
Yeah, there was a mention of food insecurity.
Yeah, assistance with returning to school. There are all sorts of barriers that harm families, and it's trying to help them overcome whatever those barriers may be.
Colleen, when we're thinking about other parts of the state, do you think that we are seeing a level of awareness of what's happening? For example, here in Chicago, you mentioned Champaign. Are we seeing this happen in other parts of the state as well?
We are. I think what we're hearing, and this is an unfortunate consequence, but also somewhat helpful in our thinking about this as being a statewide issue, is the issue of opioids. And people are starting to have to face the fact that this is happening in every community across the state. And so we hear from school districts that maybe previously weren't addressing these things, but now they're feeling that the need is really high, with really high rates of parental exposure with substance abuse. Or we also have issues of other types of trauma, refugee and immigrants that are moving into communities that have been through trauma before they left their country of origin, while they were traveling, and now they're here. So looking at this idea of sort of how do we realign resources, and we also have a lot of families in Chicago are moving outside of Chicago. So we're seeing those collar communities that really didn't have the kind of social service networks that the city has are being now asked to develop in pretty short measure a lot of supports for kids and families. And the trauma lens we're finding is one that's very, very helpful, because it starts to say, how do I think differently about my job? And also, how do I advocate, link, and build sort of a network of supports around my school and community that I can link kids to services when they need more than the schools can provide? And so it's really helping that conversation to sort of structure that conversation.
We're almost out of time, but Natalie, can you just tell us quickly when this collaborative, when it will start?
It has already started.
Mm-hmm. It sounded like Broadway. Okay, so it's already started, but this $9 million, which was recently announced, will also help with this.
Correct.
All right. Well, thanks so much to WBEZ Chicago's Natalie Moore for being with us. She covers the South Side. I want to thank Colleen Cicchetti for also being with us, Executive Director of the Center for Childhood Resilience, sharing with us also. She's the Clinical Director of the Illinois Childhood Trauma Coalition as well. Both of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Last fall, an Illinois company that was once the largest retailer on earth officially filed for bankruptcy. I'm talking, of course, about Sears. And even though Sears has been around since 1893, I think many listeners know that these days it is a shell of its former self. And when we talk about Sears and its decline, we usually point to the ways it didn't adapt to the modern economy, especially the growth of online retail companies like Amazon. But Sears says that its former chairman and CEO, Eddie Lampert, is another big reason why the company lost so much money and jobs, so much so that there's now a lawsuit involving the CEO, Eddie Lampert. Sears says these losses weren't just because of bad decisions. They amount to theft. The lawsuit says, quote, altogether, Lampert caused more than $2 billion of assets to be transferred to himself or Sears' other shareholders and beyond the reach of Sears' creditors. Suzanne Kapner covers retail for The Wall Street Journal. She's on the line with us now from The Wall Street Journal newsroom in New York. And we're also joined by Margaret Wright, a corporate law attorney and assistant professor at the U of I's Gies College of Business. Suzanne, Margaret, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Suzanne, it's one thing to say someone did a bad job as CEO and chairman and cost the company a lot of money. It's an entirely other thing to have a lawsuit. Who is exactly suing Eddie Lampert here, and what are the accusations here?
Okay, I think the first thing to understand is there's really two Sears today. There's an old Sears, Sears Holding Corp, which is the company that filed for bankruptcy, and there's new Sears, which include the Sears and Kmart stores. The Sears Holdings, the company that filed for bankruptcy, no longer owns those stores or other assets. It's basically a shell of its former self. And it is suing Eddie Lampert. It's basically the lawyers, you know, overseeing the bankruptcy process, trying to get as much money back for creditors as possible. And, you know, they're accusing Eddie and some former directors and members of his hedge fund of, you know, mismanaging the company and siphoning off assets, which is something, you know, reporters and columnists and observers have been pointing out for years. In fact, in 2013, I wrote a story about this and talked to a lot of creditors saying, like, why aren't people more upset about this? But, you know, now it's a little bit late. The money's gone.
Suzanne, I did want to ask you about the timing of this, because certainly for people who have followed Sears closely, this is not necessarily new, thinking about how much Eddie Lampert profited off of Sears' demise. But can you speak to the timing of this during bankruptcy filings?
Right. Well, so the reason they're suing now is because the trustees of the estate of this shell company, you know, they still have creditors to pay. Creditors want their money, and their job is basically to claw back as much money as possible to pay out claims. And so that's, you know, what has triggered this lawsuit at this time.
Margaret, how common are lawsuits like this when we're thinking about between a company and its former CEO? Certainly, perhaps people might see this happen in smaller companies. Have we seen this on the company the size of Sears before?
I think that this kind of a lawsuit is not really that typical. I mean, you see it in situations where the CEO has had some kind of malfeasance, but they're not that typical. But you have a situation here that's pretty unusual. So in that regard, I'm really not surprised to see this lawsuit being filed. It's a situation where you've got a CEO and the chairman of the board is affiliated and owns a company that is the largest, I would say probably the largest lender and one of the largest purchaser of assets from the company. So there's just a lot there that went on. So I wouldn't, while I think these kind of lawsuits are not necessarily an everyday kind of occurrence, I can certainly understand how this one got filed.
Margaret, as you're describing that situation, it almost sounds like that seems like there would be a law against that. Like the chairman of a company taking a company into bankruptcy, also being the largest shareholder of the company that's lending it money. But are there?
No, there. I think there's no law against that per se. I think the deeper issue here is conflict of interest. And it seems like for years the way these transactions were coming down with the chairman and the president or the CEO having so much of a conflict of interest where his company is buying and dealing with Sears, I think that that's kind of an issue. But I think the ESL, the hedge fund company, and Lampert have said that, you know, even though this might be an unusual situation, the board of directors of Sears approved it. We did everything that we were supposed to do. And therefore, you know, we were good guys and we shouldn't be sued on something like this. But again, there's nothing, your question was, is there anything illegal about it? And the answer is no.
I'm speaking with Margaret Wright, a corporate law attorney who teaches in the College of Business at the University of Illinois. Suzanne Kapner is also with us. She covers retail for The Wall Street Journal. Suzanne, to Margaret's point, first of all, what has Eddie Lampert said publicly about this lawsuit?
Well, you know, over the years when people have accused him of what is, you know, known as fraudulent conveyance, basically siphoning off these assets, he said, look, you know, all shareholders were able to participate in these spinoffs. So Eddie, being the largest, obviously got the biggest chunk, but anybody who owned shares of Sears could also end up with shares of these companies that have been spun off. And he says this was done, you know, simply to keep Sears afloat, that the company was in dire straits and needed money, and these transactions were done to sort of, you know, inject much needed cash into the company. So he has, you know, says, well, I'm the good guy here. I have tried, you know, and he did put his own money in. Yes, it was, you know, collateralized against real estate, so there was much less risk than other creditors. But, you know, his point is, like, I did everything to keep this company from filing for bankruptcy. And at the end of the day, you know, it just, you know, he couldn't prevent it.
And what does Sears say in response, Suzanne? What examples are they giving when they say that Lampert was actually not doing his job as chairman and CEO, but instead profiting off of Sears' demise?
Well, two interesting examples. One has to do with the spinoff of Land's End. And Sears, you know, it's no secret that Sears had been trying to find a buyer for that business for a long time. They said they were not able to find anybody willing to pay, you know, a decent amount of money. So they ended up spinning it off to shareholders. But the lawsuit says that they turned down a $1.6 billion offer from Tommy Hilfiger and a private equity firm. So that's, you know, that's pretty damning. And then this real estate partnership that they set up that ended up buying a bunch of Sears' best stores, the lawsuit claims that, you know, this was done in a way that gave favorable terms to the REIT known as Seritage Growth Properties and disadvantaged Sears, the operating company. So, you know, those are two examples where, you know, that sort of counter Eddie's narrative.
I wonder, Margaret, this sounds pretty complicated, as most complex business deals get. What does Sears have to prove in court here, or what are they hoping, assuming that this does get to court, Margaret, what would have to be proven here to show their claim is correct?
Well, as Suzanne said, she talked about two instances where there was, I guess they're alleging some sort of malfeasance or fraud. So they're going to have to show that there was, in fact, these were fraudulent transfers, both the one to, I think it was Seritage Growth. I think there's an allegation in there that they the properties were sold for inadequate consideration or for no consideration, and they're going to have to prove that. They're also going to have to prove, in the case of Land's End, that it was really either malfeasance or some kind of fraud to turn down the Tommy Hilfiger offer and go ahead and spin it out. I think that the Land's End ended up reaping about $500 million to Sears, where it could have otherwise had $1.6 million. So that's what they're going to have to prove. It's you know, the burden of proof is a preponderance of the evidence, and but they've, you know, fraud is not the easiest thing in the world to prove, but they've got situations here that, as Suzanne pointed out, that are pretty unusual, and it's an ongoing basis. I mean, it kind of these transfers have been taken up the through the life of Sears, and so there's plenty of facts there that would, I think, substantiate some of these claims, but that's what they're going to have to prove.
Suzanne, the lawsuit also includes our current Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, who happened to also have been Eddie Lampert's college roommate. Why was he also, why was he included in this? And I imagine there's quite a few other folks that are named in this lawsuit.
I mean, he's a former Sears director, and he did work at Mr. Lampert's hedge fund for a while. So that's why he was included. And some of the other people named, including Bruce Berkowitz, another fund manager, was a big investor and a lender and also a former director of Sears.
So when a company files for bankruptcy, Suzanne, I think a lot oftentimes people don't are, you know, the average consumer isn't exactly sure what happens next. And I wonder, as we're thinking about Sears now, how many, if they're still, if we're talking about Sears and Kmart stores still open, how is the company doing now?
So what happened is Eddie Lampert bought about 220 Sears stores and 205 Kmart stores out of bankruptcy, plus some other assets. And those were the best stores. A lot of them made money, not all of them, but and he is using that those stores to sort of form a new company. He's now also made an offer to buy the Sears Hometown and Outlet stores, which was originally part of Sears Holdings. It was spun off. And as a result, Mr. Lampert owns about 58% of that company. He's made an offer to buy the rest of it that he doesn't already own. And his idea is he wants to go forward with focusing on the hard lines, which is what Sears has always done best with, you know, the tools, the appliances, the lawn and garden equipment. He's announced already three new stores that Sears will be opening this year, much smaller, you know, a fraction of the size of a typical Sears department store that will only sell hard lines. And that also is why he's interested in acquiring the Sears Hometown and Outlet stores, because they, for the most part, do focus on the appliances and the tools and, you know, the things that where Sears really excelled. But but there's a sort of a coda here. He's already at odds with the board of Sears Hometown and Outlet stores, fighting with them, and it's not at all clear that, you know, this deal will work out.
So it looks like there's lots of questions going forward, not just regarding this lawsuit, but the future of Sears, Suzanne?
There are definitely lots of questions. I mean, he's got about 425 stores that, you know, he certainly has a shot at making this work. But, you know, the odds are stacked against him. He's going to be competing with giant chains, you know, with 1,000 stores, Best Buy, which is doing very well today, Home Depot, Walmart. He's got some, you know, of course, Amazon, some very tough competition. And the, you know, the Sears of today no longer has the scale or the clout with suppliers that it once had. You know, so he's not giving up, but there's, you know, it's certainly not a sure thing that he's going to make this work.
That's Suzanne Kapner, who covers retail for The Wall Street Journal, been covering Sears for some time. I want to thank Margaret Wright for being with us as well, assistant professor at the University of Illinois College of Business and also a corporate law attorney. Margaret, Suzanne, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, we're going to be taking a look at the process for legally buying a gun in Illinois. You need a background check, but you don't actually need to get fingerprinted. And some state lawmakers say it's long past time for the state to close this loophole so that people who shouldn't have guns shouldn't get through the system. You can always head to our webpage, 21stshow.org, to find past shows, find our social media handles, leave us a voicemail, find our number to text us during the show if you want to ask us questions. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.